Today is Thursday, June 17th, and you're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedu Ofor, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Coming up, President Biden faces new challenges in U.S.-Russia relations.
But despite holding the summit in a 19th-century Swiss villa, the stage for past landmark agreements, differences remain, namely on Ukraine.
Plus, WFP seeks urgent aid for millions in Africa and Yemen.
WFP has been forced to cut rations for millions of people. In some cases, he says, this has meant taking food from the hungry to give to the starving.
Also, Japan lifts coronavirus emergency 1 month before Olympics. Our top story today is in the U.S. U.S. President Joe Biden has returned to Washington after his summit with President Vladimir Putin to face a host of hot-button issues. Despite positive assessments of their meeting, clear differences remain. White House correspondent Patsy Widas-Kuwara has this report from Geneva.
In the Swiss villa in Geneva, an exchange of diplomatic pleasantries acknowledged by U.S. President Joe Biden.
The tone of the entire meetings, I guess it was a total of 4 hours, was good, positive.
And his Russian counterpart, Vladimir Putin.
The conversation was absolutely constructive.
The two sides agreed to begin talks on strategic stability and cybersecurity.
I think the fact that we've broken from a pattern of mutual penalization and a narrowing of diplomatic relations, that's important. That plays dividends for both parties. As far as concrete deliverables and changes in Russian behavior, only the next couple months will tell.
But despite holding the summit in a 19th-century Swiss villa, the stage for past landmark agreements, differences remain, namely on Ukraine, where conflict has simmered for years between the army and Russian-backed separatists.
I communicated the United States' unwavering commitment to the sovereignty and territorial integrity of Ukraine.
Ukraine is seeking membership in the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, which Moscow has said it would not accept. Biden underscored support for human rights, including the fate of imprisoned Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny. Putin dismissed his crackdown on political rivals and pointed out the chaos in the U.S. during Black Lives Matter protests. He is unyielding on the issue of Navalny.
He arrived deliberately acting to be detained. He did what he wanted.
Biden made clear he is different from his predecessor, Donald Trump, who in 2018 sided with Putin instead of U.S. intelligence agencies on Moscow's interference in the 2016 U.S. election.
President Putin was extremely strong and powerful in his denial today.
I made it clear that we will not tolerate attempts to violate our democratic sovereignty or destabilize our democratic elections, and we would respond.
Biden also told Putin he would respond in a cyber way should Russia launch a cyber attack.
Biden will be careful to be proportionate in any cyber response he engages in, understanding that Russia is not a pure cyber power, but a very, very capable one, and one that has the ability to inflict great harm on the U.S. using cyber capabilities.
Biden returned to Washington immediately after his summit with Putin, wrapping up a week-long tour to shore up transatlantic relations with allies. Patsy Widakuswara, VOA News.
For analysis on the meeting between U.S. President Joe Biden and Russian President Vladimir Putin, International Edition Steve Miller spoke with Dr. Ralph Carter, a political science professor at Texas Christian University in Fort Worth, Texas, where he teaches international politics, Russian foreign policy, and foreign policy analysis.
Expect really anything other than messaging and positioning by each of the respective presidents, each sort of staking out their positions on various issues. And of course, that happened. But as well, we actually got a couple of tangible things agreed to. One was the return of exchanging ambassadors, because each country's embassy has been without its ambassador for a while. And that's always helpful. And secondly, they agreed to start discussions on two really important issues, cybersecurity, which is obviously a big concern these days in the United States, but also on strategic security. And when President Putin talks about that, what he's really talking about is what we're talking about in the United States as arms control talk, sort of regulating nuclear weapons, strategic weapons, delivery systems, and things like that to help make the world a little bit more stable in that regard.
You know, one of the things that President Biden did during his conversations with Russian President Vladimir Putin was highlight that there are consequences for bad behavior.
I made it clear to him that I believe the consequences of that would be devastating for Russia.
Based on his goal to kind of reset and formalize predictable and stable relationship with Moscow, what can the president actually do, given that there are three co-equal branches of government here in the United States?
Well, one thing that the president can do is he can exercise through executive orders some powers he has to impose certain kinds of financial sanctions on Russian elites and Russian entities. And certainly President Obama did that. President Trump did that. And President Biden can do that as well. That's one thing he can do.
That's Dr. Ralph Carter, a political science professor at Texas Christian University in Fort Worth, Texas, speaking with my colleague, Steve Miller. One critical challenge facing President Biden post-Geneva is the fate of his infrastructure bill. AP correspondent Mike Garcia reports things are looking up as a group of 20 bipartisan senators have expressed support for the legislation.
The bipartisan Senate group working on an infrastructure compromise appeared to gain momentum Wednesday as the group doubled from 10 senators to 20. As he was preparing to depart Geneva, President Joe Biden told reporters,
"I'm still hoping we can put together the two bookends here."
Late Wednesday, Biden administration officials were on Capitol Hill meeting with Democratic senators in the bipartisan group, drilling down on details of the compromise proposal. Earlier in the day, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer pushed ahead on the alternative Democrat-only track that would seek to skirt the need for at least 10 Republican votes to reach the 60 required to pass the package in the Senate. Schumer convened a private meeting of Democrats on the Senate Budget Committee to set the groundwork for a majority passage process. Mike Gracia, Washington.
The United States faces a growing threat from domestic violent extremists, according to a strategy released this week by the Biden administration. The warning comes as lawmakers continue to investigate the January 6th storming of the U.S. Capitol by supporters of former President Donald Trump, seeking to derail the Electoral College vote count, confirming Joe Biden's presidential victory. VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson has more.
5 months after the U.S. Capitol attack, the Biden administration laid out a strategy for countering the threat posed by domestic extremism. U.S. Attorney General Merrick Garland.
In the FBI's view, the top domestic violent extremist threat comes from racially or ethnically motivated violent extremists, specifically those who advocated for the superiority of the white race.
Garland says that no one in the United States will be prosecuted for their nonviolent political beliefs.
There is no place for violence as a means of resolving political differences in our democracy. The long-term issues that contributed to domestic terrorism in America must be addressed to ensure that this threat diminishes over generations to come. To defuse the underlying causes of domestic terrorist attacks.
The January 6th assault has resulted in more than 500 arrests. Democrats say the rioters were motivated by former President Trump's false claims of election fraud. Democratic Representative Carolyn Maloney.
After his efforts to pressure the Department of Justice failed, President Trump grew even more desperate. And so on the morning of January 6th, he sent an angry, violent mob to the Capitol. The goal was to use violence to stop Congress from certifying that Joe Biden won the election.
The head of the FBI acknowledged to lawmakers this week that his agency had failed to anticipate the assault. FBI Director Christopher Wray.
Our goal is to bat 1,000, and anytime there's an attack, much less an attack as horrific and spectacular as what happened on January 6th. We consider that to be unacceptable.
A Senate report released earlier this month found multiple intelligence and security failures in the lead up to the attack. Democratic Senator Amy Klobuchar.
Three intelligence-related units within the Capitol Place knew about social media posts calling for violence at the Capitol, but that the full scope of these warnings never made it to the Capitol Police leadership, rank-and-file officers, or law enforcement partners. There were also conflicting reports on the threats.
While several Senate panels continue work on reforming the U.S. Capitol Police in the wake of the attack, Senate Republicans blocked Democrats' attempt last month to form a wide-ranging commission to investigate the events of January 6. Catherine Gibson, VOA News, Washington.
Israel swore in a new government with a razor-thin 60 to 59 votes of confidence in a coalition of left-wing, centrist, right-wing and Arab parties with little in common. U.S. President Joe Biden congratulated the new Israeli leader, Naftali Bennett, and said his administration, quote, is fully committed to working with the new Israeli government to advance security, stability, and peace for Israelis, Palestinians, and people throughout the broader region, unquote. Ori Ner, spokesperson for Americas for Peace Now, spoke with VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawi about the prospects for the new government.
Into consideration several things that do keep this coalition together. And we've seen in the past with narrow Israeli coalitions, you know, ones that stood on one vote, 61, that they actually have been more stable and held together better than one would expect. The one thing that we have here holding this coalition together, the main thing, is the joint effort to try to keep the outgoing Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu out of power. And that is a very strong common denominator, particularly taking into consideration the very strong sentiments that there are out there about Mr. Netanyahu. So as long as Mr. Netanyahu is still the head of Likud, as long as he has not been, you know, convicted, this amalgamation that has created this coalition, I think, is going to still hold people together. And we may see it even reaching the point of the rotation where Bennett leaves the premiership and Yair Lapid takes over.
But Netanyahu pledged to bring down that coalition. Is he capable of doing that while he might be tried for corruption?
Yes, I think he is. He's capable. He's a very capable politician. He's very shrewd, very sly, and has a great deal of power still in Israeli politics. He knows Israeli politics better than anyone else, has more experience than anyone else, and could be capable of peeling off members of this coalition. The thing is that while the coalition is narrow and has only a 61 majority, Netanyahu does not have a 60 or 59, but less than that, because in the opposition, there is one party that's the joint party, the Arab party, that is not going to vote with him. So he only has 54, and that makes it much more difficult. In other words, he will need to peel off more than just one from the ruling coalition.
That's Ori Ner, spokesperson for America for Peace Now, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawi. Iranians go to the polls Friday to choose a new president. But with international monitors banned, critics say the election is far from being free or fair. And as Henry Ridgewell reports, public discontent could lead to a low voter turnout.
Iran's economy has been shrinking for most of the last 3 years, largely because of sanctions imposed by former U.S. President Donald Trump after he withdrew the U.S. from the Iran nuclear deal in 2018, accusing Tehran of destabilizing the region, which Tehran denies. Sanam Vakil is from the London-based policy institute Chatham House.
These sanctions have impacted Iran's economy in a significant way, but above all, deeply impacted ordinary Iranians that are suffering from rising prices and a declining currency. Against this backdrop, also, of course, Iran has weathered COVID-19. It has the highest death rate in the Middle East.
Against that backdrop, Iranians go to the polls Friday to choose a successor to President Hassan Rouhani. Only four candidates remain after three pulled out Wednesday, all of them approved and vetted by the Iranian regime's Guardian Council. Three are hard-line conservatives. Just one is a reformist. Ben Taleblu is from the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies in Washington.
The regime itself, in every iteration of quote-unquote election since 2009, has been gutting the left flank of its political system, further contracting the boundaries for acceptable space, and with Khamenei at the helm, dragging the system further to the hard right.
Iran has been rocked by a series of events that have shaped the electoral landscape. the U.S. targeted killing of Iranian General Qasem Soleimani in January 2020 prompted widespread public fury. Days later, Iranian forces accidentally shot down a Ukrainian airline passenger jet, triggering anti-government protests. Again, Sanam Vakil.
So there have been, you know, a cycle of interconnected events that have dampened popular sentiment. And in November 2019, protests over rising oil prices were also brutally repressed. So ordinary Iranians are not particularly inclined to vote.
The favorite to win is 60-year-old Ibrahim Raisi, the head of Iran's judiciary. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
Hong Kong police have used sweeping national security law to arrest five editors and executives of a pro-democracy newspaper on charges of colluding with foreign powers. Thursday's arrests were the first time the legislation had been used against the press, in yet another sign of an intensifying crackdown by Chinese authorities in the city long known for its freedoms. Police said they had evidence that more than 30 articles published by Apple Daily played, quote, a crucial part, unquote, in what they called a conspiracy with foreign countries to impose sanctions against China and Hong Kong. The city's Secretary for Security, John Lee, described the newsroom as a, quote, crime scene, unquote, and said the operation was aimed at those who use reporting as a, quote, tool to endanger, unquote, national security.
The suspects have been arrested on strong evidence that they are conspiring to endanger national security. It is your choice whether you will regard them as part of you who go about your journalistic work lawfully and properly. If anybody's act causes damage to the reputation of journalistic work as a whole because they are involved in a conspiracy, then it is only to the good and credibility of Hong Kong journalistic work that action is taken against the criminals who make use of journalistic work as a tool to further their criminal activities.
That's Hong Kong Secretary for Security, John Lee. Japan's government on Thursday approved lifting Tokyo's virus emergency just over a month before the Olympics, but set new restrictions that could sharply limit fans at the Games events. The state of emergency in place in Tokyo began in late April and largely limits bar and restaurant opening hours and bans them from selling alcohol. That measure will now end in the capital and eight other regions on June 20th, Prime Minister Yoshihide Suga said. It will stay in place in Okinawa Prefecture in the south. Suga said the number of infections had been declining since mid-May, easing demand for hospital beds. He also said that in some areas, the decline in cases is slowing down. In place of the emergency, the government will implement so-called, quote, quasi-emergency, unquote, measures in Tokyo and six other areas until July 11. This is the Voice of America. A wave of brief internet outages has hit dozens of financial institutions, airlines, and other companies on Thursday. Internet monitoring websites showed disruptions across the globe. Many of the outages were reported by people in Australia trying to do banking, book flights, and access postal services. Australia's central bank also was affected, as was Hong Kong Stock Exchange. Most of the outages appeared to end after an hour or so, and they were linked to the U.S. company Akamai Technologies, an online services provider. On Twitter, Akamai said it is aware of the problem and was working to resolve it. Turkish authorities say a gunman killed one person during an attack on the office of pro-Kurdish party. The People's Democratic Party, or HDP, said a gunman entered the building in Izmir province on Thursday morning, fired shots, and attempted to set the office on fire. The province's governor's office said one person was killed. The office said a suspect was detained. HDP confirmed the shooting victim was a party employee. You are listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedu for broadcasting from Washington, D.C. The World Food Program reports swift action and billions of dollars in relief funding are urgently needed to bring more than 34 million people in several African countries and Yemen back from the brink of famine. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Last weekend, G7 leaders expressed concern about the humanitarian crisis facing millions of people who are teetering on the edge of famine. They pledged $7 billion to prevent the catastrophic possibility of hundreds of thousands of people starving to death. The World Food Program welcomes the G7 leaders' commitment to provide life-saving humanitarian aid. However, WFP spokesman Thompson Feary says this pledge of money and of preventive action comes with a caveat.
Our ability to save lives depends on unimpeded humanitarian access. And having these funding commitments come from G7, which, if fulfilled, we will be able to expand and reach those who are most in need.
Past appeals for famine prevention relief have fallen short of the mark. In March, WFP and the Food and Agriculture Organization called for $5.5 billion to scale up operations and avert widespread famine. Because that goal was not reached, Feary says WFP has been forced to cut rations for millions of people. In some cases, he says, this has meant taking food from the hungry to give to the starving.
We have cases where famine, where we need to prevent famine from taking a grip in countries such as Yemen, South Sudan, Burkina Faso, Madagascar, and most recently the Tigray region of Ethiopia. Now, for the next 6 months alone, the World Food Program requires $4.5 billion, and the consequences of inaction and these funding shortfalls will be measured in lost lives.
Lack of access to people in desperate need of humanitarian assistance is also hampering life-saving relief efforts. For example, in northern Ethiopia's embattled Tigray province, WFP officials say an estimated 350,000 people face catastrophic levels of hunger. WFP says it is unable to alleviate their suffering because armed groups are still blocking humanitarian assistance to the region. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Since the war in Syria broke out a decade ago, refugees have fled to countries in the Middle East and Europe, as well as in Africa, that face instability like Somalia. But as Mohamed Sheikh Noor reports from Mogadishu, Somali officials say Syrian refugees are enriching the host nation culturally and economically.
Zakaria Azarkan is a Syrian refugee who fled civil war in his homeland 2 years ago to seek opportunities in Somalia, a country that is still recovering from internal conflict. Now he is chef and manager of Al Warda Ashamia, a popular Syrian restaurant in Mogadishu. He says he expects other Syrians will find opportunities here and open new projects, even though Somalia is still emerging from war. There are Syrian dentists who have already opened clinics, he says, and other doctors with various specializations who operate medical centers in Mogadishu. Azarkani's restaurant serves as a meeting place for Mogadishu's Syrian community. Recent arrivals to the city come here for orientation. 13-year-old Mohamed Musa and his family arrived in Mogadishu just a few days ago. They dine with Somali locals who are now accustomed to Syrian cuisine. Musa says that he urges all Syrian immigrants or even Somalis to come to this restaurant because the food here is irresistible. He says it feels as if he was back in his home country. Dr. Mahmoud Saleh is among the Syrian refugee medical professionals offering their skills to a country that lost most of its skilled workers to civil war, poverty, and years of lawlessness. Saleh has been in Somalia for the past 4 years and has fully integrated with the local community. The dental surgeon runs one of the best equipped clinics in Mogadishu and is credited for performing safe, successful operations. Mohamed Sheikh Noor for VOA News, Mogadishu, Somalia.
That's it for our show today. For more in-depth and breaking news 24 hours a day, please visit voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, and our managing editor, Kate Pound-Dawson, I am Chinedu Ofo in Washington. Thank you so much for listening and have a great evening.